Muriel to say compliments and just say Happy New Year to all of us. Happy that we are back in one piece. I hope we enjoyed our holiday. And I think as this portfolio committee, we have got a mammoth task in front of us. As we have always been saying, when is the white paper going to be out? The white paper now is out. That means that we have got a lot of work in front of us. The country will be dependent and looking on us as the committee. And we are in a year which is also, I don't want to say challenging, but interesting, because it's the year of local government elections. And we as public representatives, we are to gear ourselves in ensuring that we have that process, which is going to be a credible process. We are looking at a time when everybody, young and old, rich and poor, are in a advancing struggle. So in that process, we must ensure that to that end, we are a setter that whatever an outcome of an activity, we are to ensure that people are healthy, we ensure that there are no incidents. The outcomes, whatever incident, come straight into the Department of Health. We are meeting at a time when the whole country is awaiting painfully for the three people that are still not being able to be rescued. And we're hoping for the best. And in this sector, I think I also would like to remind the members and the department that we have got a responsibility. And at the end, whether elected or not, in all the programs and the activities and the projects that are in front of the portfolio committee and in the department, is because we are ensure that we are addressing a particular history and a legacy that we have inherited. And we must not lose sight of that. I'm not implying that it is correct for patients to wait from 7 o'clock until 4 o'clock not to be seen. But the programs and the projects that are there are the projects that we are to ensure that it changes. So the issue that we have really, we are to ensure that our energies are to ensure that we change the social conditions of our lives, of our people's lives with of health. Those are the opening remarks from my side. We are welcoming all our guests for the benefit of those that are coming in the committee for the first time. We are to introduce ourselves. So the introduction will start from honorable members and then the department and the guests. We will use mic to introduce, tell us who you are, where are you coming from. Don't use telephones. Guests don't ask questions, unfortunately. Questions are only asked by honorable members. And I think that I will start in the introduction for myself. On my left is Ms. Majalamba, who is the secretary, who is the secretary of the portfolio committee, in my extreme left at the back, it's Ms. Ngomane, who is our content advisor. Next to him is Mr. Zube, who is our researcher. Next to him is Moses, who is also part of the research team. At the back, on my right, it's Ms. Lengesi, who is the secretary of the study group of African National Congress. Ms. Mbali, who ensures that we have our documents. Ms. Selina, who is the secretary of the office of the portfolio chair. Over to you, Honorable Minister.
Dumela, Paufela. Ke ntate Maesera, leloko la komiti ya tsa bophelo. Ke a leboha.
Good morning to everybody. I'm still Tshitshi Mahlalela, and I'm still a member of the portfolio committee and health. Thanks very much.
Good morning everyone, my name is Nontlantla Ncobedaba, I'm a member of the portfolio committee.
Good morning, my name is Omar James and I'm a member of this committee.
Good morning, my name is Henrik Falmink, I'm a member of this committee.
Good morning, my name is Zundi Soteng, a member of this committee. Gigi.
Good morning, my name is Malibone Precious Masuso, I'm the Director General of Health.
Good morning, Chairman. My name is Ian van der Merwe, I'm the CFO at National Health.
Good morning, honorable members. I'm Gail Andrew, COO, Department of Health.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Valerie Zwene, Head of Corporate Services, Department of Health.
Good morning, members. My name is Kalagas Gakama, Minister of Health.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Singile Soldada from the National Department of Health.
Our guests.
Good morning, Chairperson. It's Salma Jansen from the Dacre Institute. Thank you.
What are our guests? Over to you.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Cheval. I'm from PMG.
Morning, honorable members. My name is Ethel Chitay. I'm also a member of PMG.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Azan Dengewana. I'm also from PG.
Thank you very much. We will then request the coming in the member that has just joined us to introduce himself.
Good morning, Chair. Let me apologize for my late arrival. I'm much after a member of the portfolio committee.
I think honorable members in our department, in our guests, we've only got two apologies. It's Dr. Chuane, who's on study leave, and Mr. Imam Sheikh, who's in the portfolio committee on police. We will then hand over to the department, to the DG, to take us through their presentation. Thank you. Over to you, DG.
Thank you, Chair and honorable members. I'm presenting here quarter two and three assessments, and I will also, in addition, provide additional information to clarify some of the areas. In terms of our performance overall, there are probably six or seven areas that when you look at the dashboard, we are in the red. We'll provide information about the status as of end of December and what the elections at the end of March. So, Chair will be reporting on the six programs. These six programs, some are more administrative supportive, others are mainly where the programmatic and technical work happens in the department. And within these, we've got sub-programs, which are reported in terms of the outcomes. We've got sub-outcomes 1 to 10, and we'll be reporting on these as well. Under program 1, I want to say that we are on track. As you may be aware, we've got, for the first time, three provinces with unqualified audit opinions. And ourselves, so that makes it four. We're hoping that we'll add more provinces to the list. And these are Western Cape, Northwest, and Limpopo. But if you look at the area where we have Amber, in terms of progress, we had not received the December non-negotiable monthly report. That's why we kept it as Amber. Otherwise, we are on track. We do get these regular reports. Under the next point about efficient and responsive human resource services, Honourable Member, I just wanted to draw to your attention that we're a bit enthusiastic the department, in that the Department of Public Service Administration has given us a target of a six-month turnaround time. And we have upped that target to 4 months. If you measure us against what the DPSA has determined, in quarter three we're at 21% in that vacancies that are filled within the target of 6 months. And those that are filled within the target of 4 months, which we set for ourselves, beyond what the Public Service Administration has come up with, we see that 51%. We still want to commit to that because it puts a bit of pressure on us. We want to fill our post speedily. That's the area that I wanted to highlight. And the next, on the implementation of information communication technology, we wanted, because one of the problems that we have said officials have to continue working even when they're in provinces visiting and providing support. And sometimes access to data is a difficulty. So we're setting up information systems that can provide support and they can access the system from outside. But as we do that, we also want to ensure that our business continuity plans are in place and our information systems as such that we have disaster recovery plans. So by 31st March, we'll probably have systems in place, but we want to ensure that even manually, when we have disasters, we can recover data. It cannot just be only computer-based systems. On the next page, on page 8, I'm highlighting areas where we have Amber and not Green. I just wanted to say that on the health litigation strategy, we have now a declaration which was based on the multi-stakeholder involvement. But in addition, we have engaged the Law Reform Commission because it is our considered view that we should have a litigation authority, and this we glean from the experiences we've seen from and from the UK, that what supports the national health system is one, they have a quality commission, and secondly, they also have a national litigation authority, which has been established specifically to manage litigation costs, which have escalated tremendously. In South Africa, I mean, for national health insurance to work, we need both. We need a quality covenant, which we have now in the form of Office of Health Standard Compliance, but we also need the National Litigation Authority. So we're in discussion with with the Department of Justice and Correctional Services, but the Law Reform Commission has started work. And the proposals at the moment are that we probably need to approach this in the same way as we do with labor. You know, with labor, if there are any labor issues, you start first with CCMA. You don't rush directly to the labor court. So we'll probably follow more or less a similar kind of approach. So, Chair, like I said, we've set ourselves against these very tight timelines, and we still want to meet those. But if we are measured against a DTSA, which is what is used for MHET, we measure us against the 6 months target. On page 11, Chair, under program 2 on health claims and systems enablement, if you look at the Ember era, we said we'll have white paper. Yes, indeed, it has been released for public comment. And I'm glad to say that the minister has also extended the comment period to end of May, meaning we'll have enough time to engage different stakeholders. But in addition, we have work streams that have been established. Now, in these work streams, there's going to be technical work that is going to be undertaken, and in particular, one area would be that of the health fund, the National Health Insurance Fund. And under where we have ABA, of course, by the end of the March, we will probably have a draft from the technical work that is underway. But it's not draft that will be out for public comment. We'll show that, yes, we've done it, but it won't be. And the fund will not have been established, but technical work for the establishment of the National Health Insurance Fund would have been undertaken, and we'll be able to show what the experts are saying about the fund, how it should be, and so on. So that work is underway, and we can report at an appropriate time. On page 12, Chair, if you look, there's progress, except for the ACFS. We have draft regulations, but because the National Health Act prescribes that we should consult provinces before any regulations are promulgated. So these regulations will be discussed at the technical NHC, and therefore thereafter at the National Health Council, after which then we will promulgate. So by end of March, indeed, we will have this achievement, but for now we put it because we have not as yet reached the target. So the rest of the other targets, I think we're on course. We're making progress. If you notice on page 13 and 14, but I'd like to refer you to page 15. On page 15, Chair. On page 15, this is about the project that we started on medicines through the centralized chronic medicine dispensing and distribution system. Our target for the second quarter was 350,000 patients, and our target for the third quarter is 425,000. Now, if you notice, second quarter, our performance was 246,320 patients, and for the third quarter is 322,121 patients. Now, it's clear that we have not reached those targets. Our target for end of year is supposed to be 500,000, and that is end of March. We should have reached 500,000, and in the third quarter, meaning we must have over 100,000, about 178,000 patients enrolled. Now, we have picked up that poor enrollment actually is in two provinces, in Mpumalanga and Northwest, and the team will be working with these two provinces but we also have not included data from the Western Cape as yet, because the model that they followed was different. So if we include the data, obviously, the figures will be much, much higher. The second one is about contracts that are available 6-8 weeks prior to expiration. So this is a new target. It's precisely because there were problems with the pharmaceutical contracts, and we're checking this to make sure that when they go out, it's actually 8 weeks in advance, so the suppliers can prepare on time, you know, and be able to supply the facility. With the new target, we'll be able to report on how well we fared by the end of the financial year. The next is about the review of criteria for approval of the pharmacy license. We've come up with the criteria. They've been published for comments. The closing date was 21st December, but we put it at end because they are not yet formalized. They must still, again, once more, go through technical NHC and NHC. It's just to ensure that there's proper governance. So by end of the financial year, this will be green, but we thought we want to keep it amber because they will be final at end of March. We're on track even on that one. On page 60, honorable members, about the national AMR strategy. This one is about setting up a governance structure. The WHO has come up with a global plan of action, and every country is expected to implement the global plan of action. Now, South Africa has been ahead, that we had our strategy approved even before the global plan of action was adopted. But in addition, we wanted a governance structure that promotes principles of one health, in that antimicrobial resistance is not just the problem of the health sector. It is also about agriculture, it's about food, and so on. So we want a one health approach that will involve health, agriculture, and other sectors, and ensure that we can work in partnership. So in setting up this advisory body, the minister is actually supposed to consult our ministries and ensure that we have that one health approach and bring in experts from the public and the private sector, academic institutions, civil society organizations, because also patients that have to be educated with regard to antimicrobial resistance. Chair, on the next page, page 17, about health information exchange, on this one we are on track in coming up with the integrated patient-based information systems. In the pilots that we're conducting at the NHI pilot site, we've made progress. 350 PAC facilities were supposed to be receiving new IT hardware, and we have so far approved about 700, and as I speak, are busy delivering these to our facilities. We'll actually do far more than what we had targeted. Now, when we reach the 700, we'll have a total of about 1,400 facilities with these information systems. Chair, on page 18, you'll notice that we've got AMBER in all areas. The first one is about the setting up of a National Health Research Plan. We do have the strategic plan that has been approved, but we wanted to consult further. We've held our meetings with the Department of Science and Technology, because it's the key research department, so that there's consistency between approaches with regard to the two departments. In particular, the Department of Science and Technology also oversees two research institutions, you know, CSIR, HSRC, NRF. So we are working with them just to ensure that there's alignment. The second one is about the monitoring and evaluation plan and its implementation. Now, these we send to provinces and send a comprehensive list of indicators and data elements, because the way it works, honorable members, is that we can't just come up with indicators. We also need to know what are those province-specific indicators, the data that gets collected from provinces that is specific to a province. And I just want to cite an example. For instance, malaria. Malaria is not endemic in all nine provinces. It's only in three provinces. So the expectation is that for the three provinces, they will be the ones reporting on malaria, not all nine. So there are province-specific indicators, but there are country-wide indicators where data should be collected and in overall. And next is about the annual performance plan. We have the draft APPs for Limpopo, which have been reviewed. Gauteng, KwaZulu-Natal, Northern Cape, Eastern Cape. But by the end of the financial year, when we submit to Parliament, we must have reviewed all the annual performance plan to ensure that there's alignment. We do this because it helps in terms of coordination of our plans. It also is the work of the Auditor General, because when they audit our plans, they also audit the plans of the provinces. So there must be harmony and consistency so that we can have sort of a much more a joint approach in implementation. The patient quality care tool has been tested, but it has to be revised and made available so that we can show whether there's patient satisfaction with regard to the quality of care that we provide. So I thought I needed to say that we're on track, and I think by the end of the financial year we would have met those targets. On page 19, our annual target is that we'll have the three international cities and multilateral frameworks. This one, I think there are three kind of global initiatives that are underway. The first one is the international health regulation, and this is with regard to epidemic preparedness and responses and countries' compliance to this. I'm glad to say that with respect to the work that we're doing in South Africa, we're on track, and we can sort of keep. The second one is on tobacco. We have to bring the tobacco, the framework on tobacco, our agreements that have been signed to Parliament, for Parliament to endorse these. So that's the second one. The third, Chair, is something that is underway, and it's about the drugs, the problem of drugs. The work that the UN is currently undertaking. And this has to do with the conventions that were passed a long time ago, 1961 and 1971. And with the current drug problems that we have in the country and the abuse and so on, there's a call for the review of these. And this is work that we have to undertake in South Africa. And it requires society-wide involvement, because this is probably one of the big problems that we have in the country. So I thought I needed to bring those to our attention. The first is international health regulations, the second is the tobacco one, and the third is the one about drugs. Chair, with regard to other activities, we are doing quite a lot of work in the SADC region, in the AU, but also multilaterally. And I'm glad to say, Chair, that I chaired the executive board as the current chair, and if honourable members have time and an opportunity, can watch a webcast of the whole session for this day. But also that the Secretary General of the UN has also set up a high-level panel, and South Africa will be holding on access to medicines, and we'll also inform honourable members about that. With regard to bilateral agreements, we signed a number of bilateral agreements with particularly most countries in Africa, but also globally. In Europe, we signed with the UK, locally we signed in the SADC region, as well as in the rest of the continent. So we're on track with regard to these, and some of these actually involve us supporting these countries and not the other way around. We are seen as a resource to support these countries. But for others, like UK, it's partnership for undertaking certain events. For instance, one particular area where we'll partner with the UK is on antimicrobial resistance, so we'll be signing a memorandum of agreement. Program 3 on HIV and AIDS, just to say that on page 22, we have with us the numbers for medical male circumcision. I've actually asked the secretary to make copies available so that I can explain what the situation is with medical male circumcision. As you see, it is the dashboard is red, meaning there is an improvement. So this copies will be made available. Okay. I would like to draw your attention to this page that says total MMC from 2010 to 2016. We actually set our target that by 2015 would have reached a target of 4.3 million. Now the 4.3 million is not about circumcision as a whole. I mean every circumcision that happens in the country. Our 4.3 million target is actually a target of medical male circumcision, meaning those that we do specifically as a preventive strategy for HIV and AIDS. So if you look, Honorable Member, can I just confirm that you have this page? Okay, if you do, I would like you to look at the figures with regard to ages. Ages 15 to 49, 10 to 14 and 50 and above. You can see where most of the circumcision is happening in that age group of 15 to 49. But also to say that of all the province that is really performing very well is Gauteng, followed by KZN, thereafter Limpopo and Free State. The provinces with very low figures are Northern Cape and Western Cape. And we've been informed that Western Cape views that one, they want these targets revised precisely because of the traditional practices in the province, one, and because of those traditional practices. If we take those figures into account, it will change the numbers. But if we just have medical male circumcision, then this is all that they can deliver. But if we look at the target that we set ourselves for 2016 of 4.3, we by end of the next financial year, I think we will be able to make a breakthrough. But what we have started doing, honorable members and chair, we have decided that where there are traditional practices, we will make available medical doctors to assist. One, to prevent some of the problems that we've seen, where there are, people have been harmed in the practice, and make sure that they can at least assist and support those traditional practices. And I think these numbers will obviously change. So I thought I needed to say that the figures that we have, yes, if we just look at the quarter figures, this is the situation. But if we look at our overall target, actually we're moving towards the target. Hence I think honorable members, this presentation, and also broken according to province and according to different age groups. And honorable members, on the AIMBA with regard to antiretroviral therapy, those patients that are on treatment were set it to be 3.4, 3.6, this is our target. At the end of November, it was 3.3. I think we will reach the target. We're confident that we did not include the December figure. The implementation, the monitoring system for implementing HIV AIDS program, we will be checking the number of reports that we get from provinces. Even there, the final court has three reports have been in draft form. But by the end of the financial year, we will have the reports ready for the Auditor General to audit as we close our books. Page 23, Chair, you'll see that we don't seem to be doing very well on that page. And then we've got a read again about the male and female condom distribution. For the 52 districts, we were supposed to have plans for male and female condoms developed and implemented. Only 30 districts had plans from Mpumalanga, Gauteng and Northern Cape. And we're hoping that we'll follow up. By now, most of them will have plans. But in addition, we're also adding our condom distribution network beyond just our health facilities. And the minister will be announcing and communicating soon what those plans are. This is mainly about the plan on the distribution strategy. With regard to the conditional grant, you'll see there's under expenditure, and I'll explain that when we discuss the finances. On the next page, the annual target for the TB client 5 years, those who are 5 years and older who are screened in our health facilities for TB symptoms, our target is 50%, and quarter three we're at 55%. So it's aimed that we're hoping that we get close to 50% by the end of the financial year. So page 25 here, the TB refantism resistant plans to the initiation rate. I would like to extend this a little bit. I also shared with I think with the secretary, they're not here on TB, because I'd like to spend a bit of time on MDR TB and resistance. In that we're initiating treatment for resistant patients. And so far, although our average treatment success rate may be seen as below 50%, there are actually facilities that are reaching a target of up to, they exceed the rate. I mean, they're at 60%, while others are much lower. So it's facility-based. I just want to cite an example. Sonstral in the Western Cape is reaching 60% treatment rate. Manguzi and Greytown in KwaZulu-Natal is reaching 60% treatment rate. So it's facility-specific. But for other facilities, it's not like they're not reaching those rates. They are just not reporting. They don't submit reports on time. So we need to probably crack the whip a bit so that we get reports on time. So if some provinces have actually prioritized data capturing and others haven't, some put the burden on nurses, and the nurses are not happy that they have to treat patients and also capture data. So we have to deal with that. But there are provinces with high volumes of MDR patients, and I just want to give you a sense of in 5 provinces which are those facilities. In Eastern Cape, the facilities with high patient loads of MDR TB is Josie, Pearson Hospital, Fort Grey Hospital and Kubela Hospital. In Gauteng is Caesar Hospital. In KwaZulu-Natal is King Dinuzulu and Catherine Booth. In Northwest is Sekong. And in Western Cape is Swanstral Hospital. Now, if for instance such these facilities can have the data, because they have the most patients of MDR, and we focus on these, I think it can help us arrest but also not lose sight of those who may be underprotected because they don't get shots on time. So I was saying that because if you look on page 26, we have under MDR blind loss to follow up as well as death rate reflected because we want the number to go down. You know, our target is 16%. We're sitting at 21 in quarter three. And the death rate, our annual target is 15 and we're sitting at 20. It's precisely because we want to give special attention to these facilities. We know which ones they are, but we just have to invest in making sure that they report timely and they submit complete data. On page 27, honorable members, the postnasal visit within six days, our target is supposed to be 84 in third quarter, 82 in second quarter. We're sitting at 73. We didn't include the December data because we're always 1 month behind with our reporting. So with the December, obviously, it will be probably about maybe 75, 76, but it's still not yet where we want it, but it shows progress. Impedant neonatal death rate, our target is 10.5. It's 10.5 per 1,000 live births, and we're sitting at 12.9, still on the higher end. On page 28, we have set up a pharmacovigilance program. We've come up with an implementation plan and run pilots in core districts. So we'd like to get active reporting. Normally within pharmacovigilance program you get spontaneous report, meaning a doctor reports, there's no active surveillance. So here we want to make sure that they report and we can monitor particularly those patients who are on antiretrovirals because of the associated side effects. And what is important is to also start understanding drug interactions for those who are on TB treatment and antiretrovirals, you know, to see whether there are any synergistic effects of those products that have been used to treat them. For cervical cancer, we have to finalize the policy and have it approved. Even this draft will be discussed at the tech NHC, and it will also be finalized. But the importance is that we have consulted widely amongst stakeholders and in particular civil society organizations that are looking after cancer patients. In addition to that, we have work that has done on palliative care and a special committee that has been established for that purpose. On page 29, a consultative process again. What I was saying about the cancer strategy, there's been argument that we don't need multiple cancer strategies. We don't need one on cervical cancer. We don't need one on breast cancer and another one. Our view is that to give this dedicated attention, we should have for each specific area a policy so that we can easily track it and be able to respond. So we will have cervical cancer control policy, and then we'll have one on breast cancer, and then we'll have one on cancer as a whole, including prostate cancer. So we have those documents that we've consulted on widely, and we will be presenting them to the technical NHC and NHC. In fact, NHC is meeting next week, so we'll be discussing this and NHC in tech next week and NHC in March. So they will be finalized in March. Page 30, honorable members, infant exclusively breastfed at head dose rate. This is one area where we really need aggressive education to promote exclusive breastfeeding because our target is 50% and above, and we're sitting at about 36. Now, the contractual report is only October and November data. It doesn't include December, but even that is still not yet low, but it's an improvement considering that our breastfeeding, exclusive breastfeeding, has been quite low. I mean, we're much lower than other African countries in the region. So for the assess those of GTEP, IPV, measles. We wanted this to be sitting at less than 6%. But at quarter through at -9.5. So we're doing very well with measles, we're doing very well even with the second dose. But the EPI disease surveillance manual will be sent you this because we want to keep up the good performance on our immunization rate as a preventative strategy. Even our coaching and others are doing very well. Adolescents use health policy and implementation guidelines. We've got the policy, but we've also supported it with an app, a mobile app, which the minister launched and which the youth is using. We're hoping this will change their minds and it will influence them because adolescent pregnancy is still a problem. So we need to really find ways of being aggressive about this. And honorable members, you may also recall that we launched a dedicated health channel on the 1st of December as a way to educate youth. Now, I would really like to invite you to watch the channels because some of the messaging is actually targeted at youth. Some of the messaging is targeted and empowering youth to understand why they should postpone their first, intimate early sexual debut. It's quite useful, but it can't just be used by themselves watching those programs. It would be good if parents also get involved so that there can be discussions, in families about these issues. The Girl Learners Against Cervical Cancer on page 31, our target is 80%. As of quarter four, we have not yet included data because, as you know, we have the immunization that will take place in February. So we would be reporting because this is when they start school. Equally, even the second dose. So the first program that we'd like to bring to your attention is low coverage of long-acting contraceptive methods and inappropriate reporting of the oral method. We've picked this up, meaning the reporting rate in provinces is very low and we'd like to invest in that. So there are two options. One is that we employ data capturers, but we've trained a lot of them, honorable members. We've trained lots of data capturers. This is work that we did in partnership with the University of Pretoria. But the problem is the uptake is very poor. The provinces are not employing them. So if we had a way by which some provinces have employed them, but not all, if we could just invest in that, it can improve our data, it can relieve pressure on the nurses and get them to do their work of caring and looking after patients. On the TB indicators, the third quarter is again poor internet connectivity, but also we've also looked at the data capturing, the reporting rates. Like I said, I've given you data of those facilities, the five areas with all these different, the five provinces with these facilities that we've identified. So we want to make huge investments to improve. Because I guess NDRTB, if investments are made specifically in these facilities, we really make a difference. Under program four, honorable members, on page 34, our annual target for uniform management structures for health facilities, particularly at district level. We have the draft, we have the job profiles, the implementation is in 15 targeted districts, but we would like this to be in all districts because we are pretty anxious. So we will be presenting this again at NAC, tag NAC next week and NAC, and we'll be finalizing this. But with regard to the facilities that are ideal,
so far we've got 233 facilities as at end of December. But the number has been going up. As of yesterday when I checked with the team, they were now sitting at 280. So I've got their commitment that by end of March we have covered all 500 facilities. Now, how we determine this, honourable members, is that we look at the the standards that the Office of Health Standard Compliance has come up with, and we go out to the facilities. We get them to work on those standards, and then we send the teams to go and validate that. And at the basis on which we say, if you score anything 75% and above, at least you can consider yourself as IT. However, if your scoring is poor on vital measures, you cannot be considered IT, because vital measures mean if you have an emergency tray and it's not filled, then you fail. So we're very strict on those measures, and if you have dirty toilets, it's an immediate fail, because no facility should have a dirty facility. So we dirty toilet. So we're very particular. So the 500 honourable members who are committing that all 500 by end of the financial year will be ready. On the next page, Chair, about the National Health Commission, we now have a draft framework. The minister will be sending out a call for membership, and this commission, as you know, will be chaired by the deputy president, like it happens in other countries. Page 36, on the Tobacco Act, we have the draft bill, which will be going out for public comment. We'll also be discussing, like I said, we targeted closing the channel so that it can be educated. If you check, you'll see that there are older women who go to the past, because we work in partnership with the Department of Sports. Actually, we've signed an MOU with them. Now, in that MOU, we are calling for the creation of gym parks, because our view is that you don't need to go to pay gym fees every month to be fit. Of course, those who afford can pay and go to a gym. But for other members of the public, they must have access to gym parks, and we must encourage members of the public to walk. And Chair, I've noticed that cycling has become a sport that is not affordable. Where people, we must also encourage Department of Transport to make cycling a habitual thing for people to do, not just the leisure sports, which is not accessible. So there are quite a lot. Pardon? So we're working with the Department of Sports, and we'll be again approaching other departments to encourage various physical activities. But we'd really like to encourage honourable members, please watch Channel 199. It is called the Good Life Network, and it's about health as a whole. It's a 24-hour channel. 37, on this one, people treated for mental disorders, our target was 28%. We said 28% of the 16.5, which is the prevalence people, will be screened. We are sitting at 14 of 16.5. And again, for mental health inpatient units attached to designated district and regional hospitals, our target is 16%, we're at 11. That is at end of December. So we're hopeful that by the end of the financial year we will reach the target. Next one, on the district implementing the framework and model for rehabilitation, we have the framework, but we're also looking at whether the district can meet these and what the cost implications are. but we will not wait for those facilities that already have. We would like to move ahead. But the strategy has been approved. We will bring this, the disability and rehabilitation services. We have a strategy that has been approved by National Health Council. The cataract surgery, operation 39, our target is 1,500 operations per million uninsured population. As at quarter three, it was 962 per million uninsured population, but it excludes data from December. So in this quarter, we hope that we'll be able to reach the target. On page 40, the surveillance system for notifiable medical conditions. We've come up with a strategy for integration of disease surveillance. We actually have honorable members draft regulations, which went up for public comment. They will also be finalized because they will be enforcing a surveillance. These are needed because it will help us with the disease outbreaks and our epidemic preparedness and response. We've got those regulations. But also the antenatal survey, the prevalence report has been produced, data has been cleaned, processed, and it's been assessed by different statisticians. And in quarter three, we started analysis. So in the last quarter, I think we'll be ready to release the report. Under program five, as you can see on page 43, we have here the area where the dashboard is red. Our annual target is that all 10 central hospitals must have full delegated authority. We've actually come up with a framework for delegation and we've assessed a few, but we would like this to be formalized in a form of policy by National Health Council. Meaning by end of this financial year, every single central hospital, in a form of policy, gazetted, must have delegated authority. The reason we do that is because we want the CEOs to have delegated authority in terms of finance, in terms of HR, and so on. What we've picked up is that some CEOs do not have authority to manage their budget, to buy toilet roll, to fix clothes. Now, they must have budget. They must be able to buy things that make their work easy. So I think we are on track. We have finalized the document. We put it right because it's not yet finalized and it's not yet a policy. But we'd like this finalized and we will share the document with you in due course. With regard to the tertiary services and the implementation of the National Tertiary Services Plan, our annual target was that we would have the following hospitals: Pietersburg, Freer, Kimberley, Gweleza. They will have a full package of tertiary services. Kimberley is providing 94%, Gweleza 33%, Pietersburg 70%, Freer 67%. And I'm just saying that they are not yet at 100% where we want them, but at least there is progress in this particular facility. The facilities that are maintained, repaired, and refurbished on page 44, our target is 188 were completed. Now, these are facilities that are also part of the IGU clinic chair. So we'll have to update this slide because we have reached about 200. I think that we gave a figure in the other, so we'll update this figure. in addition to the 188, so we have additional 145. So we'll add up the later figures and share that with you. Number of new facilities that comply with budgeted infrastructure. Of the 37 new facilities, 21 facilities comply. So as we erect new facilities, we'll ensure that it's in accordance with the norms and standards that have been developed. On page 45, the human resource for health norms and standards, I'm pleased to say that we have completed the work at district level for all the primary health care clinics. Work has begun for the hospitals. So because it's new work for the hospitals, we've targeted specialized hospitals, but also district and regional hospitals. So by end of the financial year, we will give you a report about the hospitals, but all the PAC facilities, we have completed most of them. Those that were benchmarked were 1,000, and I think we'll be able to finish because at 890, we're at 890 by the end of the third quarter. For tertiary regional central, like I said, they've started a reorientation because the tool has to be adapted to those facilities. We have five regional training centers that have been established. We met our target. With regard to mentoring and training, on page 46, we've started a program. We've actually developed a hub, which is what we should have reported. We've got a hub, but we also have we've developed a hub, but also an app for EOs, which will use as a tool to provide support to them on an ongoing basis. EMS regulations, we've finished the regulations, but there have been further comments and requests that we revise certain areas, and we will be republishing these particular regulations. On page 48, on blood alcohol, our target was 120, we're at 84,000. The toxicology report, 4,500, we've reached 2,600. And food tests, 4,000, we're at 12,628. So we've developed a monitoring system to measure turnaround times, conducted at our forensic lab. So that system seems to be working because we're able to track performance. On page 49, you'll see the area that is red, and this has to do with the sexual and related offenses. We have to designate specific facilities. Now, the Department of Justice and Correctional Services has two trailers, so we'd like to work with them to designate these. So far, we've got only 13 facilities designated out of 60. We may not reach our target by the end of the financial year. I think this is one area where we may not reach, but we'd like to pick back on the two trailers because a lot of investment has been made in those. With regard to scope of practice for forensic pathology, we've reviewed the scope, we've got the draft scope, and we'll be finalizing this by the end of the financial year, and they will serve again as the technical MHC and NHC. So we are happy with the progress that we're making here, except of course in one or two areas where we think we can. We need a bit of time. With regard to the labs, I just wanted to say that we've come up with a monitoring tool, and the toxicology, there's been equipment failures, we fixed them. At the Pretoria lab in particular, because this is where the performance was poor. In 2016-17, Pretoria lab will move to a new facility. Capacity in the Joburg lab has been expanded, and then we've also dismissed two officials who were not underperforming in one of the labs in the Joburg lab, and causing a lot of disruption. Program 6, Chair, there's been quite a lot of progress under Program 6. I'll just talk to those areas that are raised on page 64. And this is with regard to number of applications certified for MBOD. To say, Chair, if members may recall, MBOD and CCOD have their own annual reports, but we keep these so that we can track because we provide supportive functions. I just wanted to report the status now, that what will happen is that by the end of the financial year, the certifications would have increased because there are now 19 additional doctors that have been appointed to the certification committee. And this was with the help of the timber of mine and the mining sector, because it's in their interest to ensure the certification of the mines. So we have been able to appoint 19 doctors. Now we need, initially we had 2 only. Now we have 19. Of these 19, they are going to be the ones examining the lungs of the ex-mine workers so that they can be compensated. So that is the first thing. I think it's quite significant. But the second thing, Chair, if you recall, there's been ex-mine workers that have not been traced. So there's a team that has started doing tracking and tracing so that we can have them examined and have them compensated. So some of them, besides that they submitted, have missing documents. And those documents have been requested from the claimants. So I need to apologize, honorable members, in that in the documents where I wrote the reasons why we have not met the target for MBOD and security, we said that the problem under expenditure is because of laboratory equipment. Can I correct that? It's IT equipment, not laboratory. The IT equipment that we buy, it's worth 20 million rand. This is the IT equipment that is supposed to help us do valuation, be able to see for the amount of money that we've collected from the mines, is it sufficient enough for us to meet our obligations to pay compensation to the mines? Then we check and trace them. We have to ensure that there's money for them to be compensated. So there must be a valuation that is conducted, and we need to look at the data. So we've actually processed millions and millions of files, and thousands of files to be able to pay, make millions and millions of payments. Now, of those files, these are files that we otherwise never would have been assessed. And I think it would be fair, Chair, if the commissioner himself come and present, because he's done considerable work. The second set of setting up the one-stop shop, the two remaining ones we've already started, is Bekkerhout and Kuruman. And this is where we're easing the burden of mine workers, that they do not have to travel all the way to Johannesburg for their claims to be processed. So we're bringing the service closer to where they live. So those are the two. I thought I needed to explain that the delay here was that. But the second was because we had a labor action in the at MBOD and CCOD. And one of the officials has been suspended, who has reported to have misbehaved, and she's undergoing disciplinary action. So, Chair, that concludes my presentation, and I'll just give an overview regarding expenditure, and then hand over to the CFO to give details. If you go to page 58, you'll notice that our expenditure is at 73.9, which is almost like 74%, and we're supposed to be at 75. So I think we're on track. And at the end of February, yeah, we're at 85%. So end of February, end of January, we're on track. So we're just monitoring that we don't overspend, because most of the invoices are coming through. The area where there's underspending is under National Health Insurance, Health Planning and Systems Enablement. And this was because the project on DRGs that we had started was delayed. We could not spend the money because we were supposed to have done the project in the Western Cape for Hotchkiss and Tiger Bay. But now for those two hospitals, Western Cape said no, they've already done the work. So obviously we have to redirect those resources elsewhere. That's the first. The second is about the chronic care medication dispensing and distribution model. What happened is that when we started the project, we said we're going to give patients
But now it turns out that when they go to collect their medication, they collect 2 packs for 2 months' supply. So it's saving us cost, because for every month when they collect, we have to pay a fee. But when they collect 2 months' supply, we pay one. So it's obvious that we'll spend less, but we'll still reach our target, which is good. But I mean, it's something that what plans need to make. Perhaps we can save costs in that way. So those are the two issues. Under primary health care, like I said, we've bought equipment. It's currently being delivered for the clinics. Now, these are things like blood pressure machines, you know, things that are needed in the clinics. So these are being delivered, and the CFO will confirm. So I just thought I needed to give it over to you. I'll send over to the CFO.
Thank you, Chair. I'll just get the detail of some of the programs, and just to complement what DJ has said. So, program one, which is attestation, we were 70% spent in total, and by the end of December, some of the vigilance, and I'll concentrate on these, on goods and services. We were still looking at some audit costs that will increase in the last quarter of the financial year as we finalize the audit. Some detail invoices for health planners to be received by the time the training development invoices also still outstanding, and we can say that we've dealt with most of these up to in the first 6 weeks of the financial year, resulting in our expenditure going up by the end of January. The legal claims by state attorney is still to be received. We've got issues on these kind of every year. We kind of carry a very large contingency fund on our financial statements. The internal audit review also has to be done and concluded, and will be reported on this to the audit committee by the end of February. We still, when it comes to transfers and subsidies, we're still waiting for invoices from those two CETAs that has to be paid. Normally we find it's coming through during March, and we'll then settle those invoices. On our capital expenditure, we did receive the invoice tracking system. We're having our first rollout in the next 2 weeks. So this expenditure has come through subsequent to the third quarter. And also the tender process for the security system upgrade is underway. And although we think that there will be expenditure by the end, there will definitely be some funds rolled over into the new financial year on this security system. Program 2, I think DJ has dealt with most of it. We were at 62% spent by the end of December. She mentioned detail the DRG project, so I cannot elaborate on that. The transfers, there's still transfers to be done for the SA Medical Research Council that took over clinical trials from the consortium. We have to finalize the SLA before we can do the transfers. All our other transfers was made in full, especially for the HLRC for work done by themselves. And on capital, the IC10 browser is still being procured, and not entirely sure we'll be able to have this in place by the end of March. The team is working on them exactly that. Program 3, HIV and AIDS, at 74%. The biggest expenditure obviously comes from the transfers to provinces. We have significant issues on the invoices of condoms and the delivery and supply of condoms, and I'm sure you will also can talk about that. The second round of the HPV vaccines normally happen during January and February, and we do expect invoices to come through from on this before the fourth quarter. We also depend on the provinces in this regard to issue invoices, and we've been chasing up provinces quite considerably to get these invoices in time. The media communication campaign has started quite recently, and we do have an important service provider. And we could foresee some expenditure coming through by the end of March, but this program would mostly kick in the new financial year. We would have considerable spending on this matter. Some tipping works are outstanding, and some equipment, especially on computer and IT equipment, buying of laptops, etc., hopefully will be concluded before the end of the fourth quarter. Primary healthcare services, again, DJ has spoken about this, 58% spent by the end of of December. Fort Dale services, we've advertised, well, we've took over the function at the end, at the beginning of the financial year, and we've also established a structure, but there are also still some vacancies that we have to, fill, especially at management level. The DTT program on malaria, we're also looking for invoices, we're expecting invoices to come through. We've had, you know, significant issues with this supplier as well. And subsequently went out on a new tender to address the issues we've got with supply, especially in the three provinces. The prevalent survey invoices, we're still waiting for those. And there is some awareness programs on mental health that we also expect invoices before the end of the financial year. The transfer to the National Council for Against Smoking is still to be effected. Essentially, we're still finding issues with the SLA be confirmed and we finalized, and we will then transfer that, and again some equipment. Although the equipment values are not big in terms of the bigger picture of the department, they're still significant in terms of the basis of programs. Program 5 with the 74% spent, very close to what we would have expected them to have spent. Some vacancies to be filled. We have procured some equipment on behalf of provinces, which is mostly equipment that we could get from transversal tenders, about 25 million. We're getting reports that they're being delivered slowly but surely to provinces. Subsequently, we expect our invoices to come through. We have managed to pay all the universities for the uptake of medical students to about 40 million. And this function, if you follow allocation letters, it would go to the Department of Higher Education in a new financial year. But this year we were responsible for paying this, and these are intakes up to 2013 and a follow through on that. The maintenance project is going quite well in terms of expenditure, in effect, and we've paid quite a bit of maintenance invoices, but we will add an uptake again, I'm sure, in the last quarter. On the capital assets, we're still waiting for considerable invoices from our suppliers and from provinces. This is basically or mainly based on our phase two of our refurbishment projects on IT clinics as well as in the NHI district pilots sites. The lab equipment at the laboratory services, about 7 million has been delivered and we'll pay them by the end of financial year. There's also a need for more equipment in new financial year, and we're putting out specs to achieve about 12 million for delivery in May. IT equipment, we've negotiated funds from Treasury to expand the IT project at clinics, especially in the NHI pilot districts, and we've procured another 50 million. We have taken delivery of 2,000 items, and as we distribute them, we will close the invoices. There will probably be a need to roll over some of these funds in the new financial year, mainly because of the timing of the deliveries. Program 6 has 75% spent. The supply bill was signed recently, and we do have some follow-through funds from Treasury, and we're in the process of filling a number of positions. The expenditure is high because of the establishment of SAPRA and some of the commitments going with legal aspects. CCD is slow, as DJ has explained. And that should be IT equipment. We've also got some equipment at the one-stop service centers that will be delivered hopefully by the end of the fourth quarter. On the regional grants, I'll run through it quickly just to show you some of the summaries. These are mostly the transfers we do to provinces, and we've got a unit that extensively reports and monitors expenditure, and we're seeing pockets of, you know, some success in terms of our expenditure rates. So you will see, for instance, that at the end of December we were 73% spent, which is about a 3.6% improvement on the previous financial year at the same time. We're still finding that there's low spend on the MHI direct component, although the fund is not big, it's about 75 million or so. The expenditure remains low, and MPSG is at 72%. The other grants are more or less in line, and we're confident that we'll spend all the funds for those. This is a very busy slide. Essentially, it will show you the percentage spent by grants. We also track the transfers we make to provinces and what the provincial treasuries transfer back to the departments. And from there we can kind of monitor the cash flow requirements on grants to our provinces. And then we do the same analysis by province, and we can see that some provinces spend better than others, if you like. Mpumalanga is a 1% spend, and the lower one is Limpopo, 71% spend, and Western Cape is 72%. So, it's like 70% spend. So they do vary, but comparatively, to last financial year, most provinces are in a better position. This is service grants. It's a 72%. All provinces more or less within an acceptable norm. Where there was underspend, we find that provinces report superior measures on personnel expenditure. And this is a quite big issue for us, because we do appropriate funds for compensation within business plan. But if a province has got compensation problems holistically, then they make a blanket decision that all personnel it would be more permanent on personnel, and that obviously impacts on our ability then to spend on this spending on personnel. And we do advise provinces then to reallocate funds to other aspects of the business plan, but it has to go through a legal and a budgeting process. Payments for NHS, the laboratory service in Gauteng at the time, some expenses have been addressed, but this remains an issue. The misallocation of transactions, especially on medicine, find provinces using medicines, vaccines, ARVs as interchangeably when they do some allocations, but we do try and raise it with them. And then the perennial issue on these two grants for NTG and the training bond is just the ability of correcting personal linkages, so that we can make sure that when compensation gets spent, it gets spent against the grant and not against the voted funds of that, or equitable share of the province. The training bond is 72%, again a bit of mixed bag, I think at 68% spent, Northern Cape at 92%. Difficulty is promises that they do report an over expenditure, will have to make the difference good from their own equitable share. They only allow to spend up to the 100% of the grant. Free State, Pumalanga, Northern Cape showed overspend due to some once-off payments of accruals and among others on the Cuban program. This has put some pressure on many budgets for this grant. Underspending in Eastern Cape and Gauteng, Walter Sisulu, we visited them last week. They have absorbed some positions on PASOLIT. And there's also an issue with the governance at the university, so the province is not always comfortable in transferring funds, but we've trying to address some of the financial aspects of that. And as we said, the NHLS laboratory service is still an issue in Gauteng. The HVH program is 74%, mostly on target. Mpumalanga probably will overspend at 81% and Limpopo under 68%. The reasons for underspend those two is mostly because of the delayed delivery of condoms ordered during quarter two, and I did mention that we've got some issues with the supply of condoms and supply's ability to supply. And there's also been an issue of recruitment process that's mostly contributed to this. The divide grant is 26% spent. We're actually doing very well in terms of percentage expenditure, slightly above what the norm should be. The two that are underspending at the moment is the Free State and Western Cape. They're saying that what we're getting at is issues with the implementing agents, especially Western Cape. They've reported some issues with their public works as the primary implementing agents. Some delays in procurement of equipment, especially on health technology for finalized projects. Most departments or provinces need to retender equipment, and that creates massive delays in terms of delivery and completing the tender process. And you can see that provinces that are so overspend is mostly because I think in the last few years we've built some momentum in the expenditure on infrastructure. And this is now coming to some fruition in our expenditure on these projects. NHI grants, most provinces, well actually all of them are below the norm. We had difficulty in provinces grasping the grant framework and how to implement the grant framework. Obviously this has been exacerbated by austerity measures, some invoices. And Chair, we have agreed with the National Treasury that, as part of the cost cutting or the fiscal review of the department, this direct grant would cease from 1819. So next year will be the last year that this grant would be in existence. As I said, the fund is whole, about 72 million for the financial year, and the amounts per province, you know, vary, was mostly around 7 million or so. So the amount is not big, but we still have to account for the funds and our expenditure. The portion that is lying with the national department on behalf of provinces, which we call the Schedule 6A, in our grants, on the NHI component, as DG reported, the CCMD is underspent because of these reasons. But because it's within the NHI component, in underspend there, we would probably be able to move that fund over to our GP contract, which is doing quite well. At the end of December, it was a 72% spent. I can confirm that by the end of January, we were at 85% spent of this fund. The issue that was largely of underspend won't be there again. On the GP component, we've broken down to show the current and the capital portions. On the current expenditure, which is our first flood maintenance, we are 20%. We don't foresee any issue in spending these funds. The machinery equipment fund is still a bit of an issue. And as I explained to you, that the IT equipment, as well as the funds that we bought on behalf of provinces, is getting delivered now. And we foresee at least 85% of those funds to be spent by the end of the financial year. That's our target. We hope to achieve it. The fixed structures on the capital portion, we probably would be able to push up the expenditure to about 75% by year end. But there's some delay, especially in implementation of some of the implementing agents. And then lastly, the HPV component, quite low at the moment, but as I said, that the last round, or the second round of vaccines take place in February, and we're waiting the invoices from provinces as well by the end of the financial year. So I will leave it at that. There's some explanatory notes, but I've already spoken to them. So I'll leave it at that. Thanks.
Thank you, Jim. The guidance of the committee.
Thank you, Secretary Jim and the team. Honorable members, there is the report on the TED Court. I'll take hands. I see for now there's one hand up. Honorable James. Honorable Volner, Honorable Mason, Honorable Ndaba, in that order. Honorable James.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much to the DG and our colleagues. I mean, this is complex stuff, and you show full mastery of its detail with great comfort. So that's really, you know. Admirable. I have three questions. The first had to do with this whole issue of delegated authority to hospitals. Could you tell me that whether hospitals now would have the delegated authority to negotiate who it is that removes medical waste? Because presently those tenders are concluded on a provincial level. I've asked the Auditor General to look into those, because there's evidence of quite serious maladministration in certain provinces. But I know that I speak to CEOs at hospitals that they would like to have the ability to actually negotiate the tenders directly when it comes to security at hospitals, medical waste removal, and who does the gardens. So that was my one question. My second question had to do with toxicology and blood alcohol tests. I'd like to know what the turnaround time actually would be if we can get that information. You say it's improved. Are there some numbers to look at? And my final question is, I don't have how much have you spent on the NSI? I mean, from all the various programs, is there a consolidated figure that you can share with us, and what percentage of that figure has been spent on, and is there reasons of concern?
it seems to me that we actually can't absorb that money. The health systems, the health department cannot absorb the NHI budget presently. I may be wrong. If I can get a consolidated view on that, please.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, and thank you to the DG for that comprehensive presentation. I just have a few questions. I'll try to keep it as bullet pointed as possible. The first is on the issue of the NHI, the funding paper. I remember last year when the Minister said that we would have a white paper, which we really are happy that we've received, that there would also be a technical sort of funding paper from Treasury, I believe, and that these two would have to be read together for us to completely understand the entire proposal. So the question is, just in terms of when will that technical paper be available to us so we can get these two pieces of puzzle together? The second question is, I've read in the media that there are regulations coming in that will make it difficult for dental systems to function. Now, dental care as a whole is absent in this quarterly report, which is a challenge because it's a very important part of service delivery. But be that as it may, this is very critical. You know, what impact is that going to have in service delivery when the axon's down, and will there be a transitionary period for those dental systems who don't quite make it? Because obviously that this is important for service delivery. Then on page 46, once again the Leadership and Management Academy is mentioned. I did ask, I think it was Dr. Gott last year, about progress. Where is this academy? When can we see it actually fully established and functioning? Then on page 54, this is a very painful issue of compensation of workers. I mean, this is an issue of basic social justice. We've had this come up time and time again over many years now, and there's still this bottleneck. Now, we know that there are problems at the MBRD. We understand there's labor issues, etc. But we've got many brilliant minds in our country. We've got many dedicated people. Can't we just have a focused plan on how to get rid of the bottleneck of compensation plans and then a longer-term plan of how we can begin to harmonize COIDA and ADEMWA, because that's the ultimate source of this problem. We need to harmonize these pieces of legislation. So if you can comment on the immediate-term solutions and also the longer-term legislative solution. The second and last question is the austerity measures mentioned on page 77. Can you just give us some understanding of how this became a fashion to introduce these austerity measures, cut those costs with such unfortunate consequences, where then obviously service levy isn't fully functional because money that should have been there isn't. And it boggles the mind a bit. And then finally, we are also facing the issue of the drought. And these kind of plans can't really accommodate for these crises that come along. But my question simply is, as part of the inter-departmental response to the drought, does the Department of Health have enough resources in terms of finances and personnel to deal with some of the worst-case scenarios this drought can bring? Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to know how far is it in the school health program progressing? How far is it? And two, why are we not breastfeeding our children? What is the major obstacle here? It looks like we are the worst culprit as far as breastfeeding is concerned. What are the problematics here? Thank you.
Thanks, Chairperson. My question is with regards to the financial check. I see here on the financial that the many outstanding invoices and equipment, and my worry is I'm not sure whether those invoices are not submitted to the institutions or to the department, and whether they are outstanding because the department hasn't paid the service providers. Maybe if we can get clarity, will be fine. But I'm also worried that if we've got so many outstanding equipment, I'm not sure whether the department has a plan on how to fast-track the delivery of these equipment, because they can be outstanding for a long time until we forget. And I can cite an example, for instance, in Natal Street Hospital. They've been having a complaint of outstanding equipment. Even now, during the December holidays, I went to stay. They were still complaining that there are some equipment that they have received that up until now. So can we get clarity on whether the department has a plan on how do they ensure that all these equipment are delivered to the relevant institutions, and the outstanding invoices, whether they are paid by the department or they are submitted by the service providers. But also, sir, I'm worried about invoices that are not being paid by the department or the institution. Yeah, it's the department, whether it's national or provinces, that I don't see any whether I can say a remedial plan or any penalties that are being introduced by the department to make sure that they disciplined officials who don't do their job, but they are getting paid every month. Thanks, Susan.
We just have a 10-minute break just to allow the department to just sort or see how they are going to be responding. And then we come back and get the response from the department. I think I'm going to have 10 minutes break. Thank you. May we start? Thank you, for the department, time to respond on questions. Over to you, teacher.
Thank you, honorable members, for the questions. I will respond and then ask my colleagues to respond to some of the questions that have been raised. The first question that was raised about delegated authority of hospitals is that the intention for the future is that the central hospitals in particular must have more authority and power to be able to act. At the moment, we're testing a model of which areas that can be done. At the moment, some of the tenders are transversal tenders and are coordinated by Treasury. So we'll have to look at what the economies of scale would be, you know, for certain contracts. Because obviously, if each province, each hospital does its own tender, the cost may actually be high. So we'll have to identify specific areas. We are looking at mainly those areas that, in our opinion, are necessary to make the operations in a hospital, the functioning of the hospital, you know, to be efficient. And we've identified those and we've listed those. And I agree, things like the employment of a team that runs the hospital. But we also are mindful of, we also don't want a CEO of a hospital to just go employ everybody anyhow and so on. There must be some guidelines of some sort that guide them. So it's sort of a much more systematic approach that we followed. And we'll share the document with you also so that you can know what this entails. With regard to the medical leave tender, yes, we've noted some of the problems with the current tender. There's been reports that we got from Western Cape, from Gauteng, and we've been in touch with the heads of departments of all these provinces to see how best we can address the problem on medical leave. But I think it's far more complex than that, in that, remember, the environmental affairs also coordinates some of the work on waste, and it's a dual problem. That we try to sign an MOU with the Department of Environmental Affairs, because this is where the problem emanated. But I'm in touch with all the HODs regarding this matter, and we will be discussing this at FNAC to see how best we can avoid some of the problems that arose particularly in this prompt. The second about the toxicology and blood alcohol test, the turnaround times, I'll ask Dr. Andrews to respond later. With regard to the consolidated figures on NHI, what is done actually? We identified multiple projects and the funds lie across different programs. So the CFO will give you these consolidated figures, what they are and where we are with spending. And with regard to the NHI funding paper, the white paper, what we did, because this has been a joint program with Treasury, the cabinet decision was that you can't have NHI paper as two separate papers. It will confuse the public. We must have one paper. So if you read the paper, chapter 7 of the white paper was an attempt to consolidate what Treasury has written as a separate document. So this has been captured in chapter 7. But what we would like to do is to do further work, because even that as the white paper is, I mean, it's both policy statements, and this is how you write policy. But there are certain implementation-related aspects of the white paper that we have to deal with. We have come up with an implementation plan, which is about 500 pages. Now, there is no one who can read an implementation plan of 500 pages. So it has to collapse into manageable components. And this is what the work streams are doing, including looking into detail some of the funding arrangements. But Chapter 7 is what would have been a separate treasury paper, because the cabinet took a decision that it must be consolidated and come out as one paper. With regard to leadership and management academy, I'm glad to say that today we do have a model that must be implemented. We have the app for CEOs, and we also have the hub, which is going to be the hub that drives implementation. So the minister will formally announce the academy, and I don't want to preempt what the minister will be announcing. I think it will be inappropriate, but we are on track, and I think he'll come in and present to the committee if you so agree. With regard to compensation of mine workers, can I just say that I was actually illustrating that historically we had two medical doctors, occupational health medical specialists, who were assessing the mine workers. Only two. Now that number has increased to 21, meaning we've increased the number by 19. And those two that I'm talking about, I mean, we're talking about an 80-year-old doctor, another one was 91-year-old, and one died. And I've always argued, I don't know whether I can still see the x-ray, but I'm told he did. But we lost him, he passed on. But now we've got enough number of doctors, number one. Two, with the funding that the mining sector has made available, we have now started that process of taking them, because we have to find them. Remember, some of them left the mines. They're home, they're destitute. We are going out there to find them so that they can access their benefits. So it's an aggressive program of finding and tracing. And I'm quite happy that they're doing this, because now they can benefit from what otherwise they would not. With regard to the integral, but what is nice also with what is done is that we have set up these workshops. Remember, in the past, what used to happen, anybody who came from the mining sending area, whether in Eastern Cape or Limpopo or any other part of the country, they would have to get into a taxi, a train, or whatever means of transport to come to Johannesburg to queue, and only to be told that they don't have enough documents. They would have to find accommodation in an area that they don't know so well. Now, what we have done with decentralized that, we said they don't have to do that anymore. For those who are based in Northern Cape, we said there will be a center in Kuruman. They don't have to travel all the way. At least they can travel within the province. It's much more manageable.
others in Python field, you know. So we sort of tried to set up the one-stop shops in the mining sending areas where we know that there's a concentration of people who have worked in the mines in the past. But at the moment, the problem is that some of them, even if they could have been in Limpopo, because, you know, they have to go and work elsewhere, they've probably already moved to Limpopo, but it doesn't matter. We will also have a center in Limpopo to catch them there. So it will help them assist with processing. And we are working in partnership with the Department of Labor. Now, Department of Labor, remember we've got two pieces of legislation that are the basis of compensation. Well, I don't know how in the past we, you know, this was established, because we actually divided the human body. We said if your lungs are injured, you'll be compensated in a separate department, and if the rest of your body is injured in the right place, your compensation will be dealt with by the Department of Labor. So we need to consolidate that we have one compensation mechanism. And now, with Department of Labor, Rand Mutual is the one that does the whole administration. So at the moment, we're trying to see whether the systems that we have, whether we can just have Rand Mutual do the whole administration of both compensation in terms of COIDA and compensation in terms of ODIMA, because those are two separate pieces of legislation that govern the compensation of those who have been injured, both in the mines and for lung-related diseases, and also for other parts of the body, and the rest of the other workers who get injured elsewhere beyond the main sector. So that is the plan, and this is what we're busy with at the moment. With regard to austerity measures, maybe let me explain. You see, you've got three provinces, actually, that have imposed austerity measures. This is Free State, Mpumalanga, Gauteng province. Now, the problem is that with Mpumalanga and Free State, they pay the salaries of employees through the grant. So we want to change that, because frankly it's not proper. So when their days are dark, you tighten on the grant side. So, and maybe this is where the problem is. But I guess the CFO can explain better. Drought, no, this is not a Department of Health plan only. It is a government-wide plan. We have multiple departments, and we've got a plan, a border plan with agriculture, health, and COPTA. In fact, COPTA is the one that is coordinating all of us. So we give input into that. So the COPTA is an interministerial initiative that was established by the former minister, Pravin Gordhan, with all the ministers participating, meeting regularly, and so on. So it's a much more comprehensive plan that has been developed, water and sanitation, and so on. School health, we've made considerable progress. I'm glad to say that very soon we'll be appointing audiologists, optometrists, and so on. Then they'll call for proposals, and we'll be contracting them to go to all the schools as part of our school health program to deal with the issues. We'll report to you in due course on progress. Obstacles to breastfeeding. I think this is not general breastfeeding. This is very specific. It's exclusive breastfeeding. Meaning, when women breastfeed, the baby is not supposed to drink anything else. They must just live on breast and breast alone. Now, it has some cultural issues, because for some women at home, they have to, you know, to do other duties, and they have to be at work. They can't be there all the time to breastfeed. So the question is, what happens during the day when the woman is at work, you know, because they start work at 3 months, and other 4 months after delivery. So it's something that we have to deal with. In Europe, and the infrastructure allow for that, the babies of those babies, they drive their prams, they drive them to work, the mother takes the break, go and breastfeed, the baby puts the baby on the pram, take the baby back home. And they come during tea break, they come during lunch, they come during afternoon break. The logistics that don't not allow for that. So the question is, how do we encourage breastfeeding in that way? So I think those are the difficulties. But it's important, and we probably have to look at what support we can provide. I mean, you might have seen that, in SAA, the drama about the woman who tried to breastfeed in the plane, and it was huge. So we also have to change the mindset of society, because it's almost like breastfeeding in public places is wrong, is a taboo. For us, we've been doing it, and there's nothing wrong. So we have to educate the public about breastfeeding. Outstanding equipment and invoices. Now, this one, honorable member, if you allow me, I'd like to follow up and personally with it to go to Natal first and establish exactly what the problem is, because there's a new hospital. By now, it should have had equipment, and it should have, when it was commissioned, it should have been commissioned with and been fully equipped. So clearly there's a problem there. But with regard to payment, there's a difference between payment of providers by provinces and payment by us. I can confirm that at National, the last time we had delayed payment was in April and May last year. If you look at our record, because we report, it's a statutory requirement. We have to report on a monthly basis to Treasury. So our report shows that we have zero. Every month, zero. I signed those personally. Now, for those that we had a problem in April and May, it's one individual. And we caught that individual and we acted. But I don't think this is a general practice. Now, on my part, what I try to do with provinces, I write my colleagues. I write every HOD. I tell them how much is outstanding. With pharmaceuticals, I tell them that so many pharmaceuticals have been delivered, so much is owed, and you've got so many days, 9 days or 6 or whatever. So it's standard sort of letters that I write. But I guess your point is, it's not enough just to write letters. What kind of action is they can cabinet to get decisions that people must be fired. We came maybe with a much harsher measure, a national. Well, it was threatening, but I thought it was necessary. I had said to the colleagues, perhaps what we need to do is that if there's non payment, then we identify people who hold back payment. We must also hold back their salaries for a month so that they can also feel what it means not to be paid for 30 days. Because remember, if a company is not paid, it means employees of that company are also not paid. So we said, okay, let's hold back their salaries for a month. Maybe it will bring some senses. But when we announced, I think we saw a very positive response. Maybe that should be a general trend. I don't know. It's just a thought. We tried it. So I went over to Dr. Andrew, followed by CFO.
Thanks, DJ. In response to the question on turnaround times, for blood alcohol tests, our turnaround time is 6 weeks. For toxicology tests, the turnaround time is 3 to 6 months. And for food tests, it's a month or 4 weeks. Thank you.
Thank you, Jay. The issue of the NHI and the consolidated expenditure. So if we consolidate expenditure for the current financial year, there are basically three streams. It's the NHI direct grant, the indirect portion, and then the infrastructure portion. And if you combine the budget for all three, then that would be a budget, annual budget of 174 million. And by the middle of February, let's say the end of January, the spend was 750 million. So we were 77% spent if you consolidate all those three streams of expenditure. But I can also just mention something, we have this slide, is that in the next financial year, actually over the MTF, Treasury would they will basically group five kinds of grant under NHI, which would be the rebuy grant, the indirect one, the professionals contracting, the HPV vaccines, information systems, and a new grant that's called IU Clinic grant. And those numbers, and exactly I think the point was to put all of the NHI funding into one call box or into one stream, and those budgets range from 1.2 billion next year to 1.4 and then to 1.3 in the outer financial year. So although the reporting might be fragmented, I think the idea is to put it into one stream in the new financial year. So just to recap, so if we do that for this financial year, then we're sitting at 77% spend by the end of January. The issue of austerity on compensation is a difficult one in the sense that promises they would look at the line item compensation, for instance, and they would probably take a view on that compensation line and what their current expenditure is. And if those lines are under pressure, then they will make a blanket determination on compensation. And unfortunately, in instances where we transfer funds out as a complementary to equitable share, like your training grant, like your tertiary grant, it also gets affected by those moratoriums. And if there's a line on NTSG on compensation that gets affected by the total view of compensation, unfortunately. And we've had that to some extent also on HIV component, does a little bit less. So the idea is that, and this is what pushing provinces, and we've had mixed response to say that you have to link doctors specifically on personnel to the grant. So that expenditure can reflect there immediately, that you don't have to go back and do a journal kind of entry. So some provinces have bought into it, some are still doing the journals. And that's why when you look at HPDDG and NKSG, especially in St. Cape for HPDDG, they will probably only catch up the expenditure in February, March, when they do their journals to catch up the expenditure that was there. So unfortunately, this is what we're looking at. So when we do our visit to provinces, we do encourage them to, in instances where that is the fact, to move the funds to other aspects of the business plan, so at least we can have some kind of expenditure. Otherwise, the risk is there of underspending that grant in totality. I don't think that's what we're looking at. I think DJ has mentioned the issue of equipment. I can just add to say that we negotiated the equipment budgets with Treasury during the adjustment stage. And we're finding suppliers who have lead times on delivery. So especially on the equipment, on the computers, for instance, we've only taken delivery of 2,000 items now that we've ordered in December. There's also the issue of asset management, so we have to get them together, barcode them, record them, take them to the province, get the province to accept them, barcode them again, you know. There's a bit of administrative process to do that. So I'm just concerned that we will probably deal with most of those ones, but there will be an overlap into the new financial year, definitely all over. When it comes to equipment, we on behalf of provinces, we deliver them. Last year, the first round, we delivered to the head office, which was a bit of a administrative issue. So we're now delivering back to the clinics. But again, it means that HBs have to sign off on these things, and at that time, gives me a bit of an order risk, because HB would say that at the time of 35th of March, this equipment was under your control, you should be able to account for them. It's just always possible for me, because they would now be in the district. So there are some challenges with that. Computer equipment, we wear out them initially, and then we distribute them to the clinics. Other equipment payments that we reflect there, and as I said, the amounts may be small in terms of the bigger budget. They're significant in terms of some of the cluster budgets. Some classes do delay putting out the requirements for equipment, and they delay till the fourth quarter. But the fortunate part of it is it's not a big component of the total budget, although it's still significant with it.
Okay, thank you, Chair.
No, thank you, sir. Just to raise few issues. Well, coming to the austerity measures, is one area that is very worrying, because it's one of the issues that is cited as a contributor to under expenditure of some of the grants. Is it legal for a province to declare a moratorium on conditional grants? Because I will understand them declaring a moratorium on equitable share. Is it legal for them to declare a moratorium on conditional grant without having engaged in a discussed and agreed with the national government or the national department? Because a conditional grant and is spent according to how it has been conditioned. And then so if there is a blanket of austerity measures which affect it, is legal. And how and why is it allowed to happen? I don't understand it. If you can just clarify that matter. The second issue
the year in and year out, one of the issues that is reflected as a contributor to underspending on conditional grant is delays on payment. What explanations are provinces giving? Why are they delaying to pay? What explanation do they give to you for them to fail to pay? Because you release money and time. They've got money in their system, but they are unable to pay. I'll understand delays in payment because they have not received invoices. But delays in payment, it means they do have invoices, but they're not paying on time. What explanation do they give? Because there's been a matter that has been recurring year in and year out. That's an explanation that is always been given. On the accruals, CFO, I just don't understand. This time, understanding one of the contributors is accruals. How does that happen? Because accruals, it means those accruals have exceeded even more than 30 days. And therefore, a violation of treasurer, of the PMA and the treasurer regulations. Because when you accrue, services have already been rendered. What is left is payment. And at this point in time, in the third order, you still have accruals. Not been cleared. I thought all accruals in the first quarter has to be cleared. And therefore, you won't have a situation in the third quarter where we're still having accruals. I don't understand it. If you can just clarify that. How did that happen? I mean, somebody's rendered service in February, March, but by December, that service provider has not been paid. What exactly does that mean? I don't understand. If you can just clarify that matter. And then the issue of expenditure, I mean of one of the expenditure on goods and services, especially in program one, you are citing, just go there. You're citing the audit costs. And the thing is going to pay. How is it going to be possible to pay it in the last quarter? I would have thought that you don't budget for payment of the audit for this financial year. Because auditing will only start when you close your books on the 31st of March. And therefore payment will then be done in the next financial year. Why is budgeting not in that financial year where the auditing will be carried over so that you are able to pay and then you don't have a problem of underspending and then the problem of then having to accrue certain amount of money because I'm not sure what you call it because it won't even be accruals. It's going to be a rollover. Because you can't accrue because the service will not have been rendered and therefore the invoices will not be there. They are still going to conduct the audit and therefore I would have thought that you will either pay in the first, you will budget it in that financial year and then where the audit is going to be carried over for the previous financial year and then be able therefore to pay within a either the first quarter or the second quarter, and therefore doesn't arise as a matter in your expenditure. If you can just clarify that matter. when you expect to procure at the end, if you're planning to procure at the end of the financial year, you are literally planning accruals. Is it allowed to plan for accruals? Because if your plans, no, we're going to procure at the end of the financial year, you are literally planning for accruals. Is it allowed to do that? You can just clarify that, because I would have thought that you don't plan for accruals, and then accruals happen on its own. You don't plan for it. But here, the implication is that, no, you're planning for accruals, because you are going to procure towards the end, and therefore it means payment is not going to be made. On page 67, the underpayment of capital, you've got a communicable disease cluster equipment at a value of 1 million. And you don't have that million, 1 million in the funds available. So where are we going to get the difference? If that applies to page 69, where the payment of capitals, you've got invoices at the value of 174 million, laboratory equipment of 7 million, and the IT equipment of 50 million. And in total, it gives you about 254 million. But the funds available is 189. That makes you automatically then to overspend. Is that allowed to overspend? And where are you going to get the money to balance that over expenditure? Because I was trying to look at the other capitals, I can't see it. I was looking at the compensation of employees, I'm seeing the amount is also too big to cover the environment that you might undertake. You can just clarify that matter. Okay, let me leave finances. And go to program 6 under COD. Are you saying this year the failure to certify and the failure to pay for these ex-mine workers, it is a result of the unavailability of the IT equipment? But how do you manage to pay the others? Because you have managed to pay 416 in the first quarter, and then in the second quarter you only managed to pay 411. You were able to certify 965. You were able to certify more than 1,000. But there's no correlation between what you've certified and the paid. I would have thought that when you certified, at least there must be a correlation of the payment, but there's no correlation. People have been certified by the end of the paid. And the reason is just an IT equipment for them not to be paid. Their money. But others are being paid. They are not affected by the IT equipment. So we can just clarify that IT story vis-a-vis in a more detailed way and in a more layman's language understanding. Because this thing, my ex-mine workers, is becoming a big problem. You recall last year they came in camp here and the chair was someone to go to Eastern Cape with other chairs. This is becoming a big problem. And therefore, at least you can just explain in a layman's language so that at least we are able to explain why there's such a huge delay in their payment after they have been certified, but there's still a delay in making sure that the payment does take place at the end.
On page 43, to get clarity on this central hospital, the delegation, are we only looking at the delegation on human resource? Or we are also looking at, well, I'm raising this because the issue is about, we are only talking about EBSA here. Treasurer, there's nothing, there's no involvement. It means financial delegation is not, it's not part of it. And also the issue of supply chain is not part of it. Or it is part of it, and how is it being dealt with beyond the DPSA process? Where is it now? That aspect. Because this aspect here deals only with the DPSA, which is mainly deals with a human resource related matters. But the financial delegation, which is in terms of the PMA and the supply chain process, it's not being clear here how that one is being dealt with. And if it's being dealt with, how far are we in relation to that as well, on the financial delegations? On page 34, I just want to check whether it's possible for the department just to give us a list, a detailed list of these idle units that are listed here, the 500, because you've said no, you are going to achieve 500 in any case. If you can get that list of the 500 and see each idle unit at what stage is are they. The 7 to 8, which are those that are at that level. If you can be provided by that list, if it is possible to be provided with that list, so that we are able to see how far are we in practice. The MTR TB treatment, which we are not winning, and we are saying this is the issue, it's about reporting. And if people are reporting you, we might be having a different picture. Is it not also the inversely that if they were reporting, the figure might be positive more or might be negative more? Because if they are not reporting, it means we don't have the correct figure as to even the people that are dying as a result of TB, MTR, the number might even be higher than what has been reported. And therefore, it means the figure might even be better than this one. Is that the interpretation of reporting? So that we don't look reporting only on the positive side. If the people are reporting, if they are not reporting, they might not be reporting even the people are dying as a result of that. Is that the understanding, or is the opposite of that? Well, on the male circumcision, I would have thought that you are giving us this. This is a nice picture, but the quarterly one is not a nice picture. And it's confusing us, because if we look at this one, it tells us, no, we're doing very well. But we're now considering an annual performance. And the annual performance is not a very good one. And we thought that if you break it in this year, so that at least you've got an understanding of this year, where are we not doing well? Because we are supposed to have almost 1 million by the end of the year. In terms of this, was the second quarter, it was supposed to be 250,000. I don't know what was the first quarter and what will be the fourth quarter. But for the two quarters, that is the first and the second and the third, it's supposed to be 1 million, which is 250 and 750. And when you look at it, it's not even closer to half of it, because it's 172,040,000. It is about 200,000 or so. So it's not even the quarters, the two quarters doesn't even cover the first quarter. I mean the second quarter, quarter two, which is 250,000. And therefore, there's no correlations between this 2010 to 2015 and what is currently a reflection in the annual performance. If you can just correlate the two, because there's no correlation, it's east and west. If you can just try to make us understand, if you're saying you are on course, while the annual says no, we're very far from being on course. For this one starts from 2010, and it's not really trying to assist us to understand exactly how annually are we performing, because this is not the, this report does, I mean, doesn't reflect very good at all. The APPs on page 18. So just clarify, I'm trying to interpret and understand it. I'm not understanding it. When we say we are reviewing and giving provinces feedback, we are reviewing ATPs that has already been adopted, being implemented, and what is the purpose of that? I don't understand it, because APPs, once the legislatures, once they are tabled in the legislatures and they get adopted, you can't change them. What is the purpose of that review? I would have thought that you'll be working with provinces in preparations, that is in advance, so that by the time they are ready to table their APPs, they tabled APPs that you've worked together with them, you have worked with them, then they table APPs that you are in agreement with them. But if you allow them to table their APPs in their legislatures and then thereafter you begin to review them, where is it going to assist you? If you can just clarify that aspect, because I was trying to interpret it. It was very difficult to find an interpretation of what exactly is it all about. If you can just try to assist me to understand that error of red, I'll be happy. And then lastly, Chair, the submissions of provinces of the non-negotiables. Is it possible to take us on board? What is your observation? Because submissions, compliance, is a different matter. Without your submitting, but are they adhering to these non-negotiables? Are they doing what is expected to be done? What is your own observation, Caprons? Because they can submit, but only to find that they are not adhering to it. They are complying, but practically, in terms of the implementation, you find there's a different story. Hence, you go to, you'll have headlines in the state with there are no medicines and what, but they might have submitted the non-negotiables. But the inverse is the opposite. When we went to Eastern Cape, on oversight, we find something at a very different pace altogether. But I'm sure they're submitting the non-negotiables. But practical on the ground is not what you see. So the submissions, which is a compliant matter, and what is practically happening on the ground, are you able to balance the two at the end of the day? Thanks.
Honorable.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Just two, three quick points. The first is, I had a question on dental systems. I'm not too sure that was... Okay. And then I'd like to come back, and I know what the DG has said with regards to compensation, but I should have come back to that for a moment. The three components, right? So the first is that we need to identify those who are eligible for compensation. It can be either actively or passively. Then we need to process and adjudicate and approve those applications. That's the second rung. And the last
step is then obviously payment of compensation. Now, I know Dr. Salela has already spoken about that last component. With regard to the first component, identifying, we did a visit as a committee to in Mtata to a one-stop shop, and you know, it looked very nice, but there weren't any people there. We walked the entire premises, there was nobody there. So that raises questions about identifying those who deserve compensation. I want to focus on the middle bit there, on the processing of the compensations in terms of the answer that you gave. So if you look at page 54, in the second quarter there were 2,000 targeted and 965 reached, so that's 48%. And then in the third quarter that dropped to 41% in terms of processing certifying applications. So we have this huge backlog, but we're kind of moving backwards. And so the real question I have is, this is an urgency. See, if I was, say, a family member, a child or a spouse of somebody who died under cruel conditions because of exposure to dust in mines, and I've been waiting and waiting and waiting, and there's been no progress, that's a principle of social injustice. We can't have that. And so the urgency has to, I feel, be there. So if you go back to the NDOD, where many of the cases are sitting, isn't it possible to have delegation of the director's duties to a number of different committees and have, over a short period of time, an intense processing of those applications so we can actually break the backlog at that central point, in that second step? You know, we've got a pool of OMPs, occupational medical practitioners, we can bring them in. It can be done just as an urgent measure, given the sensitivity of this. And then with regards to the second point, I'm glad that Rand Mutual's remit is being potentially expanded. That's good in terms of processing. But what I'm asking is a single legislation, a single piece of law that will actually bring together the entire compensation system in this country. Is that something that we could hope to see come before the committee before the end of our term? Is really, if I can be brave enough to ask that question. And then the last point, and I close with this, Chair. On page, I think it was 24, there's a point on your death from childhood malnutrition. 29, sorry. Your other five childhood fatality rate from severe acute malnutrition. I just want to say thank you to the department on this, because we saw in your law presentation that this is a very big problematic area, and you've improved quite substantially here. And someone once said that the moral test of any society, and certainly any government, is how it treats its most vulnerable, and at the center of that is children. And you've actually been saving the lives of our children here. So thank you. Please keep up the good work. Improve more, but please keep up the good work. Thank you.
I just got one question. Back on the compensation of the ex-mine workers. I don't want to respond on your behalf, but I'm just evaluating how you're going to respond, because it's quite a competition. But for me, the question is, there will be a person who was an ex-mine worker, went to PE, go to an institution or to a GP with a lung problem. Are public institutions empowered enough to be able to pick up and identify? Maybe a person won't say, I was an ex-mine worker, but will just go in because he has got an HS problem. Will they be able to pick them up, even GPS for that matter? So that's why I'm making an example about a person who then goes to another institution to be seen. I would have thought that this legislation, these two pieces of legislation, I would have thought that you would have come up forcefully to say, as a department, you think that this must be what we must have one piece of legislation that is then going to be able to ask, is it something that is possible, or is it something that is a so I just wanted some of the questions have been asked. For me, it's only those two questions. Thank you. Other thing, members, barristers at 2, there is no lunch here, so we must be mindful of that.
Okay, thank you, Chair and Honourable Members. Let me start by the questions on the conditional grant and whether provinces can have moratorium or not. Let me say that this is a perennial problem, and I need to hasten to say that Honourable Members, we have actually met with the Select Committee and the same Committee on Appropriations. And the CFO will show you, we transfer money, it sits in provincial treasury. They don't transfer to health. We can actually show you even the latest data. It sits in provincial treasury. Now, based on, I think, 2 years ago, in 2013, we actually had CFO go to Free State with members of the committee to sit with provincial treasury, because what it does, they sit, they don't transfer. But in terms of DORA, I'm actually supposed to withhold. But there's always a dilemma about withholding money, because if you withhold, of course, if there are legitimate reasons, you can then transfer money back to treasury. But I also don't think it's in our interest to just withhold money, because it means there won't be services. So it's that dilemma. So there are provisions. But I also think the committee perhaps need to be aware of the failure of provincial treasuries to transfer. The provinces that are always affected is Free State, like I said, Free State, Mpumalanga, and Gauteng. Those are the three, at least. Eastern Cape in the past, but it's improved. Now, where it affects I don't know whether the choice of the way to say the measures. What then those provinces do, they then hold back the money even for use of the grant. So what then happens, then the provinces use money for other things. And as soon as the grant money comes, it finds other reasons. So it's a matter that both national treasuries and provincial treasuries must deal with. The second, I think the one on accruals and understanding, the CFO will do this. Can I just respond to the one on audit and explain how the AG works with us? What the Auditor General does, we have what we call a protocol, an audit protocol, which we agree to upfront. Okay? The beginning of the financial year. They tell us which areas they're going to audit and so on. But what they do interim audits. So the interim audits are done during the course of the financial year. So we have to pay for that. And they also do the final audit. So in this financial year, they will conduct the interim audit. They will send me an invoice. I have to pay for those services. But then they then have to finalize that audit in the next financial year. Meaning their audit process does not start only when the financial year ends. They start with the interim. And then as part of that, we have to respond, and there will be a whole lot of activities. And after which then, they then continue with the audit at the end of the financial year. It's not like they disregard the results of the interim audit. That's what I needed to also clarify that. The next question about procurement at the end of the financial year, and maybe I can respond to on this one on two issues only. One on the procurement of IT equipment and also equipment. What Treasury does is that before we procure, like for instance, with IT equipment, Treasury says to us, in their view, we have to say in terms of the infrastructure, IT equipment is part of equipment, whether we can spend those resources. So when we approached them initially, they said that we'll have to have this included as part of adjustment budget. Now, the only time that is finalized is in December. Now, in December, you can order any equipment from anybody because factories are closed. So what we do, we actually get our paperwork ready so that by January, things are moving. But in essence, you only have this quarter to order, to purchase, to get invoices, and to pay. And this one, I can confirm that it was included by Treasury as part of adjustment. Because we asked, we said, can't we do this? They say, no, it will be, we'll include it in the adjustment budget. But we said, we had planned for it. They said, well, in their opinion, IT equipment cannot necessarily be viewed in the same light as medical equipment. And it is in that respect that they said, okay, wait for the adjustment budget. And this is what I wanted to explain up front, because that has been the case. The next about payment of equipment and commercial, I think the CFO will respond, and also the, you know, the potential for underspending, you know, the 254 million committed funds and the available funds, even that will respond. Can I respond to this thing of compensation so that you are clear about the definition of roles? In terms of the Public Finance Management Act, the power that I have as the accounting officer is to provide administrative support to the commissioner, who is governed by the Odimore Act, meaning the commissioner, Dr. Berdis Nathan. All these questions are actually directed at him. But my duty and responsibility is to ensure that the administrative support exists. And it's that administrative support that I was trying to explain, okay, that you are providing. Now, what do we provide in terms of, as the National Department of Health? The commissioner sits with compensation money. I don't touch it. I don't see it. I don't even know how it's administered. What I know is that when he says he needs staff, I must make sure that he has staff. When he says he needs a computer, I must make sure that he has computers. When he says he needs, meaning the relationship between me and the commissioner is administrative support. And why I brought this to attention is because he has openly that he needs doctors. He is unable to do his work, hence the 19 doctors that we have. He has said to us the security systems are poor because, you know, there's a danger and risk of the fire system. Like, for instance, what we picked up is that there are some fraudulent activity of people who claimed who actually did not qualify. So we had to ensure that there were security systems. But in that process of setting up security systems, there was labor action. Number one, the staff of the commissioner said they don't want an outsourced security, we must have in-source. But of course, it depends on the budget I have to employ more people. Sadly, the computer systems, he has repeatedly said the computer systems are problematic, and this is why I was explaining. You see, those computer systems are the ones that tell you how much money do you have to compensate. Because on the one hand, you can't go find ex-miners, but in the pot there's no money. So number one, he has to go and get the inspector of mines to go and inspect mines and say, all of you are supposed to be paying compensation. And then he puts all of that money in a pot. But then there must be valuation to say, are you liquid enough to pay compensation, whether for ex-miners or the existing miners who are in current employment. So he has to do that. Now, this system is one of the reasons why the Auditor General has repeated for the past, I think, 3 financial years, that said, I'm disclaiming you because this data does not make sense. I can't. So the miners, meaning the mining companies, have been saying, we don't know whether the data that you have is adequate for us to pay. You know, because they have to pay a certain amount so that people can be compensated. So there's been this debate. So we said, fine, we'll do the evaluation. We'll support the commissioner to do the evaluation. We'll ensure that the files are in order. So we employed previous unemployed graduates who have gone through, I don't know how many, 500,000 files, which otherwise were not processed at all. So they have processed those. That I say it is fair to say it would be good if the commissioner comes and explain exactly what has been done. But the budget that we have for him, I think, is a limited budget. It's probably 55 million, meaning we have 55 million to support him to do work, to compensate, meaning to process 1.7 billion. Meaning that 55 million is administrative support that we provide for him to do 1.5 billion. So the solution that we put up front, which we discussed with Treasurer, is that because the Rand Mutual has capacity
and the Rand Mutual has been doing administrative support to the Department of Labor. Why don't we use that resource so that we can have this compensation done? So we're in discussion at the moment with the Department of Labor to achieve precisely that. So I'll repeat that our role is to appoint doctors, to ensure that their computer systems, to ensure that files are properly, they're available, they can be accessed, but also support the commission so that payment can be done. But before payment can be done, there must be doctors who check the lungs to see whether people have diseased lungs or not. That's what triggers payment. So we only have two, we now have 21. I think that on its own is sort of a movement towards a progress in towards a compensation. With regard to page 43 and delegation on central hospitals, I need to hasten to say that the minister has actually taken this as his personal matter on hospitals. For central hospitals, what the minister has said, in fact, it's not only central hospitals, central and tertiary hospitals. He says there are four things, and I always ask the fifth one, four things which, if we do not address them, even NHI will not be a success. And I mentioned them, and he will present them again. He says it's HR, it's finance, supply chain, and infrastructure. But if we do not get this right, then forget it. Now, one of the things that we are trying to address in terms of the delegation is not only HR. It's HR, it's finance, supply chain, infrastructure. Now, it is on these grounds that the minister has actually set up a special team for this purpose. He's taken former HODs that Ren held in the past, you know, and also Dr. Ralph Mchima, for instance. He's been a commissioner, he's been an HOD, he's one of them. So I can go on with the list about who the members are. Now, they met recently, they are going to be working with us. But we start with the central hospital. Dr. Craig Housen, who was the head of health here in the Western Cape, remember, he also ran Free State. So he has an experience of two provinces. And he will know what is it that worked in Free State and what is it that has gone wrong. So we've got that team together, waiting to ensure that we can look at HR, finance, supply chain, infrastructure. But in addition, we need guidelines. We need guidelines, we need documents that CEOs themselves can have, that they can use as tools, including the development of that hub, as well as an app that is developed for them. So on page 34, on ideal clinics, indeed, we will share the list of the ideal, and with the breakdown per province, as to which clinics, where they are, what their status is, and so on. We'll forward that, you know, as soon as possible. MGRPD, data, let me explain, honorable member. You see, at the moment, the provinces, when they don't report it on, we've identified hospitals with high burden. Now, we know the high burden is in those hospitals. But it's not enough to just know that they have high burden. We know that they've got more cases. But they must tell us how often people come to take their medication. And we must see for their lab results whether there's progress. Is there progress with resistance? We've put them on treatment. Remember, we've just put people on treatment for MGRTB. And we're rolling this out to the rest of the country. Now, we have to at least know that their success rates. And it's on those grounds that we need to see the reports flowing in. Now, if they don't report, we don't even know. Our view is that if they report, at least for the high burden, because we know them, we'll know whether the patients are getting better or not. This is the kind of reporting that is missing from the web-based systems that we have. They're not sending that to say, these patients, yes, they've been treated, this is where they are, this is what is missing. But we do have the data of the patient. We know the patients, we know who they are, we know where they are. But we want to know whether are they getting treatment. And I think this is the data that is not flowing through. On the medical minister condition, what I was trying to illustrate here is to say that our target is actually a much longer-term target. I know that we've broken it down to quarterly, but frankly, honorable members, it would have been more workable if we're reporting on an annual basis to say we set this for 2016-17,
But on annual basis, this is where we are. Now, because those figures will change, I can assure you, if we give you the end of December, end of January figures, they will obviously be different. What we have not included in these figures, which we correlate towards the end of the year, because we can't go to the private sector partners, neither can we go to the NGOs that we work with and say to them, give us figures on monthly and quarterly basis. We don't do that. But at the end of the financial year, we ask the private sector partners, we also ask NGO partners, because they get money through donor funding, but we work with them, and we take those figures into account. But we do not impose the quarterly reporting from them. We ask that on annual basis, and it is for that reason. We will do the correlation for you and show you how the figures mesh, including those that we collect from civil, from NGOs as well as the private sector. Let me explain the APP. Our process is as follows. It's actually a regulated process. The first process is regulated in terms of treasury regulations. So we start that process early in the year. This time, by end of February, we're actually ready to submit. What we document here is to show that we've already gone through all these processes. We have our team, which is led by Dr. Andrews, go to every province. They spend time in provinces to sit and work on the development of the plans. But what we insist on is agreement on indicators. Remember, I explained that we have to agree on indicators, what they collect nationally and what they collect locally at provincial level. The reason we do that, but we also insist on getting the district plans, because we also do not think that having a provincial plan alone is enough. You must get the district plans, because the performance of the province depends on what happens in district. So we get the district plans, but we submit the draft to presidency, to DPME. So all this process, in a period of 1 year, we must have gone to provinces, we must have collected district plans, we must have submitted to a presidency, but the AG also insists on looking at our plans. Before we submit to AG, we must have tabled our plans to the audit committees, and is what we encourage the provinces. But the last step is that those plans also set at AHC. So it's a process. By this time, by the time we table the plans in Parliament, and by the time the provinces plan, we've done their cycle. It's not post facto. We do it through, meaning the process for 2016-17 is going to start now. The teams will be going, starting consultations. It's a cycle. We do that all the time. So the dislocation, the only dislocation we have, is that these plans, when they serve at technology next week, the tabling of Parliament is on the 15th of March. It means we will recommend to NAC to say, this is what we have recommended provinces should table. It means that the NAC is not going to sign off. NAC is going to have this information, but we have given every MEC, on our part, the minister would have had a copy of what has been submitted. Now, honorable members, the National Health Act actually prescribes this, meaning it's not just what is required in terms of the treasury guidelines, but what is the guidance and policy of presidency. The National Health Act is very specific. It says that the planning must be done in this manner. So it's imposed on us. We don't have any flexibility. We have to do it in terms of the National Health Act. So our target of the 15th of March, we have gone through this. Now we're going to start again, all over again, for 16-17. And it's a whole cycle again. On the submission of the non-negotiables, I think the CFO will respond to that. The dental assistance, maybe let me say that, sure, the dental problems, I'll put it broadly, there have been problems in the manner in which there's been interpretation of the law. The South African Dental Council has taken the department to court twice. One, because we're prescribing the scope of practice for oral hygienists, but also the scope of practice for dental assistance. The first case we won, and just this past week,
we want the one on Dekala. I think it has to do with their understanding of their role as centers. That they have the view that expanding the scope for dental assistance as well as the oral hygiene will be encroaching on their roles as centers and so on. I think it has to do with that. But what we have our view is that the regulations that were promulgated by the Health Professions Council and the scopes of practice that have been determined, we were persuaded that they were intended to expand access to dental services, because I'm convinced that we do not have enough dentists to render dental services everywhere. So we will need the dental assistants, we will need the oral hygienist and any other oral health worker and dental skills in the country to be able to respond to all health oral health problems that we have. We can ask that we prepare a summary, our legal team and legal training, prepare a summary of what the outcome of both those cases are and what the implications are. With regard to the conversation, I've responded to that, and the underlying thank you for the comments, and I'll hand over to the yes.
The capacity and the ability of public institutions, when X9 workers go to them, are they able to pick that?
Yes. What we're trying to we prepared a document at the moment to see whether this service can be rendered at primary health care level. Now, Dr. Kisnasami, we can share that with you, because it is, Madam Chair, as you identified, a shortcoming, because it means F9 workers can only go to certain facilities only. When they go to this hospital, they won't be assessed. So we're trying to see how we can integrate our services, but we want also to get it, because it's easy to ask a service at primary health care level. But Dr. Kisnasami was working on a document to address that, and we can share it with you, even in draft form, even though it's not finalized. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Jay. Thanks for these questions. I think I get us all thinking. The issue of, I think, you just mentioned the issue of austerity measures. Just to add to that, is that two grants that we do transfer, the NTG and the HPTVG, they're supplementary to equitable share. So you'd find that the provinces, as I said, would take a view of total compensation and make a call on that when they employ austerity measures. The issue of delaying payments, what we've seen from provinces is that they're cutting, in many cases, the cash flow of that province. And if you look at our page 74, slide 74, It would show that the amount that was not transferred by provincial treasuries to our provincial treasuries, our provincial department. So on page 74, if you look at that, you will see per grant what is not transferred, and you go per province, you will see that. And this is some of the issues that they raise, say there's a delay in payment because of the cash flow. In many cases, many provinces do not split between the conditional grant cash flow and the equitable share cash flow. They see there's one cash flow and they get one amount per week to make payments from. I know in Gauteng, for instance, we've managed to get them to split the cash flow. So they will have a cash flow for compensation, for conditional grants, and one for equitable share. And that seems to work a little bit better. Other departments, other ones like KZN, they don't, in the past, they never quibbled about what they transfer the next day. Other provinces feed funds back to provincial treasury. So we've engaged, so when we go to provincial structures, we also show them this slide, which is quite insightful, and it's page 74, and it shows, it will even show per province, per grant going forward. The issue of accruals that contribute to retirement spending is definitely something that is worrying us as well. And you're correct, accruals should not be kind of blamed for expenditure, but if you look at a simple one of the NHS, for instance, we've had accruals going back a couple of financial years. So provinces, they still deal with legacy issues when it comes to accruals. I'm not saying it's the right accounting principle, but unfortunately this is what some of the reasons we're getting for current expenditure. I think basically what you can say, you should not plan for accruals. I think if you go to when we move out of the modified cash accounting system, we'll probably, you know, plan for kudos of 45 days or 30 days at least. In a cycle, but the idea is not to have accruals planned for consciously. I think it is a part of the accounting structures that happened by year end. Yeah, I think DJ has addressed the issue of the interim audits. So we do interim audits. The audit cost is a year-round issue. We pay for interim audits. We pay for regularity audits. We also pay for audits of performance information. And there's about one or two performance orders that get done throughout the financial year. So we do have payments monthly to the AG, as she has explained. She's also explained the issue of the equipment. I think the improvement that we can make on this slide that speaks about the let me get it quickly. Yeah, is that those invoices also relate to commitments that we've made. So especially on the infrastructure. Is multi-year projects, and that commitment spreads over a number of years. So you find that although we say invoices not yet received, probably the construction phase of that project will happen in 6 months or 7 months time, and then we'll be able to process those invoices. But I think I take the point for clarity. We should probably refer to, in this case, you know, to commitments rather than invoices for order place. When it comes to the laboratory IT equipment, those were orders placed for this financial year, hopefully to be delivered in this financial year based on the adjustment budget that was received. We can also just, you know, say that when it comes to rollover funding, Treasury would consider rollover funding if it's a capital commitment or capital expenditure and the funds have been committed. So we're not saying we'll get rollovers, that was dependent on their view, but at least there is a window for that. But in this case, I think we'd really like to spend and finalize these two projects on the equipment, especially before financial year end. The issue of the communicable disease cluster payment, again, I'll have to go back and just get a proper review of that. It's correct that the amount available exceeds the explanatory notes. We have to go back and see if some of these funds were not received or some of the invoices were not received by the end of December, and we'll have to amend the variance. But I'm happy to go back and confirm exactly that state of play. The issue of non-negotiables, I think correctly so. We've established a culture of reporting the report on time for the most part. We get it from, we get the reconciliations. We're able to make sure that we're getting correct information compared to Vulandela and BAS and all the rest of it. But when you look at some of the reporting items within it, and I'm happy to leave the slideshow with the secretary. You will see that many provinces, they put fund, or they try to ring-fence aspects of the non-negotiables within their total budget. But you also find that the expenditure on a monthly basis and the dashboards for this show that they can overspend or that there's a risk of overspending. And they range from extremes to the other extremes. The recent cap, for instance, will show big potential for overspending the total basket, and other ones like Free State will show they're underspending again. And you try to continuously reconcile that with your conditional grant and with your cash flow expenditure. What we're also encouraging provinces is to say that if certain items of a non-negotiable is going to overspend, because it's a goods and services item, you can actually move those funds between the items. So you can decide and say, look, my medicines is going to overspend and equipment might underspend. You can make that adjustment on an accounting system to get your dashboard or your books at least balanced to some extent. So the value of non-negotiables has been there to ring fence or earmark some of the funding, and also perhaps to get the reporting culture going. Yeah, leave it there, Chair.
Thank you very much. I think we have had a very informative process, which among other things is going to, I think it is when we then have to be conducting our oversight, we are being able, among other things, to be focused so that we do really have to understand where our shortcomings were. At the end of the day, the work in my understanding is that it happens at the provincial level, and therefore if in us conducting our oversight
we are to, I think we are to sit as the committee and relook onto an approach that is going to make us to have a more understanding, and it is us that at the end are to ensure and make provinces to account. The second one is that knowing that it's quite a challenging, they've also got something to do with the constitutional imperatives, but as the legislative arm of the state, I think we have got that responsibility. We are also entrusted in ensuring that when we conduct our oversight, we are more focused. And the issue of X-Mine water is quite a challenging because it all goes with tracing. Some of them are migrants coming from neighboring states. I don't want to say it's easier said than done, but if you really, when the commissioner comes and the other parties involved, I'm happy when you have raised the issue of that. There's fraudulent practices. People who are coming up claiming that they are ex-mine workers and which they have not, others, they are nowhere to be found. You know, the whole, it's quite a complex situation, but it does not mean that there is work is to work for. Maybe it will be important that the three committees at some point in the presence of the commissioner to just come, labor, mineral resource, and health, and the commissioner, so that we are taken on board of what is it that we are, which also, I think in my view, I'm subject to correction, what compounded more is this issue of the legislation. And I think until the issue of legislation is being addressed, maybe in moving forward, we will then have to be. And I hope, DG, the integration in primary health care, that must be, I think, is one of the softer issues that can alleviate some of the challenges in terms of examination and other issues. And thank you very much, honorable members. We have come to the end of today's meeting. I think, I'm sure it's not, there are so many questions that are to be asked, and members are free to you know, in some of the issues that I think the CFO said that he's free to leave the slides with the secretariat. We'll appreciate that. The breakdown of the ideal clinic and whatever, we will appreciate that if it can be submitted to the secretariat so that when we meet again, we do have that information. Did you?
Based on what you said, you give us an indication that you also want the non-negotiable when you do the oversight, so that you can also, you'll indicate whether you need it. And also one on the legislation regarding the two laws, OGMO and COVID. Because the Taylor Commission recommended that, and the president, I think, and they are overseeing the work, and the commissioner works directly with other departments. So there is that process which, and maybe when he comes to present, he explain further.
Thank you, honorable members. The committee stands adjourned until further notice.